interesting. It was a lot. It was very intense, I guess. I mean, for a lot of reasons, I would say, you know, like a few other people I've talked to, there are moments of like total relief of not having to like do anything and go anywhere and being able to make bread and go on bike rides and all that stuff. But it was also really lonely and isolating, obviously, for everybody. I actually had a really crazy experience during the pandemic, or for me anyway. A lot of crap was going on in my life. So in a weird way, like the fact that it happened during the pandemic actually allowed me to deal with it all. Because I was, both of my parents got sick. So I was basically caretaking them. And so I was really in a vortex of caretaking my family during the entire pandemic. So, so that's what I was doing. And weirdly, it just lined up perfectly with the pandemic. Both my dad and my mom got sick, and I was their primary caregiver. So, yeah. So it was a wild, weird time.
not entirely dissimilar for myself. I had, I live in Queens. And so Queens, like April, March, 2020 was like this was the epicenter of the entire thing.
Right.
And I remember I got Bell's palsy and my rabbit died. And it's just this thing that I've noticed like within like weeks of each other. And I've noticed that when I go through something, it's never one thing. And yeah. I don't know if it's the universe or what, but this stuff always just compounds for some reason.
It's really intense. I don't know. It's me too. I don't know. I mean, why? I don't know why that is. But there's a reason why when it rains, it pours is a saying, because it actually happened. I don't know. Why does that happen? I don't know. But yeah, that was my pandemic. It was just like, I had a crazy sequence of just like stuff, like, in a weird way, I'm like really glad it all happened at the same time, because it was so chaotic that it was like, all right, like bring it on, bring the shit on. I'm like, okay, so here's what happened. And well, of course, we also had Trump. So, you know, like that was like made everyone's brains like in pain. Yeah.
It's this thing of like, oh yeah, things were not good before the pandemic, and you forget about that.
Yeah, that's true. Well, yeah, he had only been in there for a little while, right? No, wait, how long had he been in prison? Oh, no,
he
sorry,
would have been like
sorry,
three, sorry. Three years?
Okay, so it's all a mess. So, yeah, I guess we were dealing with that, and then the pandemic happened. That's right. I guess maybe my parents... Okay, so it's for me, I don't know, it's like a black hole, because I was dealing with my parents this whole time, and then the pandemic happened. Okay, so anyway, it's okay. But, well, lots of weird stuff happened to me. I went to Thailand and I got sick. I got home and I was like sick, mysteriously sick. And they couldn't figure out what it was. And then it turned out I had this like, I was sick for months, just like not terribly sick, but I was just in pain. And then it turns out like, this is so random and I don't know what I'm telling you, but it turns out I went to the doctor, and she was like, they finally figured out I had this like weird not a parasite but a bacterial infection from Thailand, but anyway, she was like, don't look it up on the internet, whatever you do. And so, because it has the same name as the Black Plague,
wait, it's bubonic?
Yeah, but it's not, it's just the similar bacteria, it's not the same one. But I thought that was pretty funny. I was really proud that I had the bubonic plague. I didn't, but it was...
But you tell everybody that.
Well, at the time, I was like, this is pretty cool. Yeah, I was pretty proud. But anyway, and then... So what happened? Then during that whole period, my partner of 12 years and I broke up. So I lost a long-term relationship. And then my dad got cancer and then had an operation and then got... dementia like really fast from the operation. So it was like, that was really hard. And
is that a thing that I've never heard of that?
It does happen if you're, you know, he was 87. So it's like what
you're predisposed to it, and that kind of just like exacerbates it or accelerates it, maybe.
I think so. Yeah, that's what they said. So that was really intense. And then my mom's health was declining too, and she got cancer. And so I was caretaking both of them, and it was really, really challenging and stressful, because it was all on me. And because it's hard to get old, and
it's hard to watch people get old.
It's hard to watch people get old, and it's hard. Yeah. And just, it's crazy to like, you know, we're all going to lose our freedom at some point from illness, from, you know, our physical bodies declining. That's just like really hard. So,
if we're lucky,
it's like, if we're lucky, we're probably going to go through a period of a lot of suffering at some point. I get it's true. It's so bleak, but it's true. And none of us want to think about it. But anyway, so yeah, I was basically just caretaking them, and then the pandemic happened, and it was a lot at the same time. But then the good thing that happened was I worked on a record, so now my record's coming out. So that was my the thing that I did that made me happy during that time.
Is there a way in which, obviously, there's a very real way in which you were using this new record to process things, but was it also a distraction?
Well, the reason why it wasn't was because the pandemic was happening and I had no time frame or no pressure. It was just something I was doing over a few years of in my free time. You know what I mean? And I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I just was, I had more time because I got my parents' help, you know, so I wasn't there all the time at their house. And because I wasn't doing anything else besides taking care of my parents and working on my record, that's all I did, you know, like, if it was a distraction, I wouldn't have been doing it because I was like very hyper focused on taking care of them. So I didn't have to go anywhere. I just was in my basement and their house, which is right down the street. So if I had been touring, yeah, I couldn't have done that. So I really lucked out in a weird way that the pandemic happened because I was able to be there for them, like totally, you know. I mean, I didn't have a choice. If I had been touring or anything else, I would have had to not done it, you know? So it worked out in a weird way.
I know you have a brother, but this kind of fell on you because of proximity?
No, he wasn't around. He wasn't involved.
As we're talking about this idea of, you know, when it rains, it pours, or things coming in groups, I think there's a certain extent to which, obviously, like, these very unfortunate things happening to your parents, that was kind of a freak coincidence. But sometimes, like, it can be a little self-perpetuating, you know, like, this has impact on other aspects of your life as well, and then things can kind of spiral. But do you feel like the stresses that you were under between the pandemic and your parents, was that a strain on the relationship?
Of my boyfriend, do you mean? Or, oh, no, that happened right before my dad got sick. So he was gone. Yeah. It all happened at this. It was like, he was gone, dad got cancer, got dementia, and then it was just like bang, 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 one thing after the next. With also, because he had a lot of very dramatic episodes since he had dementia. All kinds of stuff happened. I don't need to get into it, I guess. But as we all know with dementia, like a lot of stuff, he got violent. You know, it was like a lot of stuff, like managing that. Yeah, but it, after a year, he was much happier actually and doing great. And I had so many nice times with him. It was wonderful. And my mom. So ultimately looking back on it, I think of it as a gift completely because I just got so much closer with them and It was great. You know, in ways I hadn't. And it was great because of that. And even though there was a lot of suffering going on.
I remember, you know, during the pandemic, I would be talking to, like, especially, like, touring musicians, you know, who, like, weren't really around to see their, you know, their kids much, like, and would in very hushed tones talk about the ways in which it was actually kind of a blessing. Or I interview a lot of cartoonists, and, you know, they need to be alone for long stretches of time, so they kind of enjoyed
it.
But you would do it in hushed tones, because obviously you don't want to sound like this horrible thing was good for you. But I think it's a good sign that you're kind of now able to accept that for how horrible the entire situation was, that there were actually some, like, nice things to come out of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I guess for introverts it was okay. But yeah, no, there was definitely obviously a lot of loss and hell for a lot of people.
Are you an introvert?
Of course, yeah.
There's no of course.
I don't know why I said of course, but it's just like, can't you tell I'm so weird?
And you have obviously, a cat. Obviously, you're an introvert.
I mean, come on, I got.
I also am an introvert, but, like, you know, I can do stuff like this, and obviously you can do stuff like this, and then you can go out on stage and perform. And it took a really long time for me to reconcile those things, because, like, logically they seem like they're at odds with one another.
Yeah, that's interesting. So. Do you feel shy in everyday life?
I am fine. Like, if I'm going to the store and dealing with, you know, somebody who works there, like, that's fine. I don't have, but it, for me, it's really manifests itself when I'm the worst. I could, like, go out on stage. I'll like moderate panels and that's no problem.
Yeah.
But if I'm at a party where I don't know anybody, I just completely shut down.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? I don't know. I mean, I wonder if everyone has different reasons for that happening, or if it's like there's similarities. Well, what do you think's going on in your head when you're at the party and you shut down?
I have an issue engaging with people who I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, we're, you know, if we really want to get into it, there's this weird part of me that ticks in where I'm like, oh, I'm a burden, or people don't want me at this thing, so I'm just going to, like,
that's
a ghost.
That's it, though. Yeah. That's it. I think it's, like, negative stuff in our brains, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I get it. Yeah, no, me too. I think that's what it is. And for some reason, you don't have, when you're doing, moderating a panel, or you're performing or something in public, like, there's a reason for you to be doing it. You're not, you don't need to worry about what. Yeah, I sort of. It's just different. It's more of like it's a thing that you're doing. You're performing. So that's not, it's a different way of connecting, I think.
In your case, like, you've got a set list. In my case, I've got questions. And you've got a little bit of a safety net that you don't when you're meeting a stranger.
Yeah. Yeah. When it's like, you feel, okay, so they, I think maybe what it is there are certain places where you just feel more vulnerable, or like not, yeah. That's probably what it is. So I know, I think shyness, because I'm like, yeah, I've had social anxiety. Now that I'm in my 50s, I don't as much, but I have I was so incredibly, I have panic attacks constantly as a, I would say like 14 through 30. I was like a mess, and I'd have like, there was definitely a period where I couldn't even talk to anyone. Like, I had a couple close friends, but then, like, if I were to meet anybody, like, in college, like, meeting a stranger, I would, like, literally have crazy panic attacks. So it's all anxiety related, and I think it's all related to self, like, what's going on in your brain, or, like, what you know, self, yeah, like, the what you're telling yourself, or, you know, what you... Yeah, I don't know. So definitely. And I think at this point I don't care anymore as much, but I still have the one thing that I know that I have, which I is an issue for me being a musician, is the residual effects of shyness in my body, which is that I'm like super tense around people a lot. And I'm the reason why that's important for me as a musician to work through is because it gets in the way of my singing. So, like, I can't open up.
Oh.
So I'm working on that. Yeah.
Do you get nerves?
Yeah.
If any of these things were obvious to me, Mary, I wouldn't be asking you
all the time. No, I mean, I'm sorry. I'm always nervous around people.
But I mean, like, on stage, do you get nerves?
Crazy nerves. Yeah, like, so intense. There's a weird part of my brain where I can push it down and I can ignore it, but it's still there driving me, making me super tense, and I might not know that. But, like, that's definitely, like, a way that I've gotten through performing is just, like, yeah, I mean, well, first thing that helps is that you've rehearsed it, right? So, you know, like, you don't have to, like, freeform anything because it's rehearsed. And the second thing is that there's a place in me where I can just, like, repress my anxiety about in that specific situation, even though I'm still really anxious. But if the crazy thing is, like, if I could never, ever moderate a panel, like, that is the most terrifying thing to me. People have asked me to come in to talk in front of people, like, you know, like some kind of,
like, South by Southwest kind of thing, or
yes, that kind of thing. Or, like, I had a friend who's teaches this class on rock music. And he asked me to come in and talk. That is, like, the most terrifying thing I can ever imagine doing, having to stand in front of an audience and answer questions or talk. Like, I think I would die. I would, it's terrifying.
Yeah, that's what makes this all so difficult, is there's no logic to any of it.
Wait, what do you mean? Logic to, the anxiety.
Yeah, in terms of, like, how it manifests, because you're right, because, like, that's something I can do. And I've, you know, you talk about being able to kind of tamp that thing down. I think what I've gotten good at is acknowledging the nerves and almost sort of, like, using that adrenaline rush to help me.
That's good. Wow, really? So how does it help you?
When you get that adrenaline hit, you know, there's the, like, lizard brain part of you where it's a little bit fight or flight. And to me, it's sort of,
yeah,
you know, your heart gets pumping and, like, you know, you're, like, more alert.
Yeah.
And you're more engaged with things.
Huh. But so it doesn't shut your brain down.
It used to.
But what did you tweak?
I will tell you I'm going to ask you the same question.
Okay.
So for me, it was a couple things. For me, meditation was a huge one. Have you ever meditated?
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, I do all kinds of stuff. Yeah. Meditation. But meditation specifically for this, or just in general, you mean?
It took me a long time to actually be able to, like, meditate with any efficacy at all. It was very difficult, mm-hmm. because I'm, like, such an anxious person, and, you know, it's hard to shut my part of my brain off.
But
what I realized is, for me, one of the big values there is that it's something, once I start doing it with regularity, if I'm doing it, like, 20 minutes every morning, then that's something I can tap into. There's, like, a calm that I can tap into, and that was very helpful for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, also, I, like a lot of people, this is a more recent thing, but I, like a lot of people, like, hit a wall during the pandemic, you know, with health stuff and everything else. And I finally started seeing someone, you know, and a therapist, and not a relationship.
I like that. It's like a comedy bit. I finally started seeing someone, a therapist. Yeah. You know.
I found out a thing that I suspected for a long time, which is that I have OCD, and that I think part of my anxiety stems from the O part, which is obsessive, which is, like, obsessive thoughts. And that's what, I get stuck in that cycle talking to somebody, and that can be really distracting. Or, like, you know, like, when people talk about intrusive thoughts, they're talking about, like, that thing of, like, oh, you know, walking up to the edge of a rooftop and, you know, thinking about jumping off, that will really distract you if you're thinking, like, what's the worst thing I could do or say when I'm on the stage in front of all these people?
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's so intense. I mean, I feel that. I can relate. It's really intense. Yeah.
That's it. And then just, like, getting better as an interviewer, like doing this long enough, and then also just like finding a way to just to tune out the audience as much as possible. But I don't know that's not really a thing you can do in the same way.
Yeah, no, it is. Like, you can pretend you're in your own bubble. That really helps so much. Yeah.
I mean, the lights are down most of the time. That probably helps.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think all those things are so great. I mean, I think that helps definitely, because then you don't have to imagine what people are thinking. That part of leaves your brain and you just are able to feel what's happening more. If you imagine that you have the bubble around you when you're on stage, that's true. Yeah, no, those are all such great things. I love that.
What switch flipped when you turned 50?
Oh my God. So much. No, I mean, I relate. I've been, you know, I've done so many different things to try to figure out my life. Like, there are lots of different kinds of therapy and stuff. And I've always been into yoga and all kinds of things. I've done lately I've just been really, because it's all music related. So I have been coming increasingly aware of how all the negativity in my head has affected my body. So I'm really, need to move and stuff. I've done a lot of different things, like Alexander technique and like I do exercises to help align my body, you know. Anyway, so
I actually don't know what Alexander technique is. What is that?
He's this dude who lived like in the beginning of the 1900s, who was an actor, I think, who lost his voice, and he developed this whole system by like going inside of his own mind with like feeling where there's body tension and gripping and letting and how to let it go. So yeah, it's basically like this system of how to be aware of your body and how to have a posture that's aligned in an effective way for you. And anyway, so lots of stuff like that is what I do. I do this whole thing every day that's like all these weird stretches and kind of a meditation and breathing, and like I was constantly working on that stuff. Anyway, so wait, what was your question about what happened when I turned 50? I don't know. Like, everything shifted in my life. You know, like I said, it's like my role reversal with my parents was a big deal. Letting go of a lot of things happened for me. And also something happens, I think, with women at this age that's like, there's some sort of shift where you start. I don't know. I think of it as like we have had to learn to live a certain way. You start realizing how you've made yourself small because of society, and that's what society asks you to do for your whole life. And you start getting old enough where you realize like you don't. That's not the best way to, you know, that it sucks. At least that's how I am thinking of it. And that, and you just start getting treated a little bit differently by the world too. Whereas and you hear women say this a lot, and believe me, it's true, because I'm this age now where you just don't have as much value in everyday life. Because anyway, I can get really into this stuff. But
it's interesting.
It's absolutely 100% true. So that makes you go like, you know what? I don't give a fuck. Like, I'm going to do whatever the fuck I really want to do, because, you know, this is all getting very out there. I don't really know what's coming out of my mouth, but yeah, I'm going through this period where I'm just like, I'm letting go of making myself small, and just coming into my own power a little bit more inside of my head, which is a great feeling and hard, but it's good.
You know, I'm going to show my privilege on this one, but, you know, in much the same way that for me, it's sort of hard to reconcile this idea of being an introvert and, you know, being able to perform. Like, it is, I there's nothing that I've seen of you that would lead me to believe that you were making yourself small. I mean, you know, you're a rocker, and you're a Rolling Stone guitarist.
I know. Well, that's the thing. Like you're saying, it's like there's one person that's on stage and there's another person in everyday life. And a lot of times, like, the reason why we're doing this stuff is because I feel like a lot of performers are really shy, I think, in their everyday life. Yeah. No, I have had that comment before. People that know me, I'm very different. In my, you know, I'm like not at all the same person. That, you know, like you, yeah. If you knew me in real life, you wouldn't. Yeah, I'm not. I'm a weirdo. I'm a hermit. I don't leave my house. Yeah, all those things.
Do you ever perform just acoustically, like just you on stage?
Please, God, no. You don't.
That's what I figured.
Yeah. Please don't. No, I've tried. It's really hard. It's not my skill set. You know, some people are so good at that. Maybe someday.
It's not your skill set, but also, like, there's power in being in a band.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot more instruments, which is fun.
You know, I don't want to say there's, like, stuff to hide behind, but it's not. Everything isn't entirely. I mean, obviously, when you're out there singing, you know, eyes are mostly on you, but, like,
yeah,
you can kind of lean on people. Well, you can lean on people more than you could if you were out there with an acoustic guitar.
Oh my God, that's the most vulnerable you can be, especially if you're not good. I mean, then if you're not good at it, then it's like, it's not like me. I'm not good at that. Some people are really good at that. I'm trying to get better at singing and stuff, and I ultimately, like, if I could play a show that was like solo guitar, that would be fun. That I could totally get into.
Like a Ted Leo kind of thing. Just you, like, doing your songs with the guitar.
Oh, I love Ted. And yeah, no, that would be, he's amazing. No, I mean, like, classical guitar, or not singing, no singing involved. Then I'm fine.
Do you play classical guitar?
I was getting more into it last year. I did when I was younger, and last year I spent a bunch of time doing duets with my friend who's a really good classical guitar player, and I was practicing like 5 hours a day at one point. After I finished mixing my record, my mom died, and then I got through doing the mixes on my record, and it was like so much stuff ended at the same time. Then I just jumped into this project where I was practicing classical guitar for like 5 hours a day for 2 months. And then I fucked up my back and I had to stop because I was like sitting wrong. Anyway, yeah, I love that. Like, in a different lifetime, I would be an instrumental musician and not sing, because I actually like doing that stuff more in a weird way. Like, I can be cut off from my emotions and be shy, and it's awesome. It's fine. It's totally fine, because all I have to do is move my hands around. I don't have to actually interface with the world through my mouth. Yeah.
Is there a place where what you're doing now musically and that could potentially intersect?
Maybe someday. That's what I was thinking last year, but we'll see. Another thing that happened during the pandemic that was really, really, really fun for me is that I started studying lute, which was so cool. And I actually
people can't see it, but my jaw like literally just dropped as you said that.
Yeah, I got my lutes right over there. But I have a friend who's an early musician. She's a viola da gamba player, and she's so inspiring to me. And I love learning about music from the, you know, 1500s, 1600s or before, or whatever. And that in another lifetime is totally, I would be really into that. But there's only so much time in the day. But I am going to get back into it, I think. Anyway, yeah, but I had to stop because I was like working on my record, and I just couldn't do both. So unfortunately, I put the lute down, but I want to get back to it.
Don't get mad at me, and I swear I never do this.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Can you play a little? Can you play a little lute for me?
Well, I it's really out of tune right now, and it's all messed up. And I also if I had known that we were going to do that on the podcast, I would have practiced.
Didn't occur to me to ask you to play the lute on the podcast until you mentioned it, if I'm being honest. But one of these days. Aww. One of these days.
Yeah, one of these days.
To a certain extent, that kind of gets back to like your pre-guitar days, right? I mean, you were playing other instruments early on.
Yeah, when I was a little kid, I took viola lessons. I was not good at it at all. I sucked, but it was still something I did every week. But yeah, and then I got into guitar, and then I went to this music high school, so we did a lot of guitar playing at school and a lot of lessons, and my teacher was like an R&B jazz guy. He was amazing, and I just learned so much from that, being at that school. It was an incredible place for me as a lost, depressed kid. It was like the best thing that could have happened to me. And then I wanted to study classical guitar in college, but I did 1 year, and I didn't like the music program where I was, so I stopped, and I just was like, I just want to write punk songs and not do this stuff anymore. At the very young age of 20, I decided I'd had enough of studying music. And I've always sort of regretted. I wish I had gotten a degree in it, but whatever, it's okay. You can always do that later, I guess.
To an extent, I mean, making that commitment to go to a music-focused high school, it sounds like, you know, in junior high or middle school that you already were, like, pretty aware of what you wanted to do.
Yeah. Luckily, yeah, that happened. I just lucked into that. I mean, it was like the public school here in DC, and it's a wonderful place. I don't know what I would have done without that school, honestly. It really saved me. So, yeah, I was in the DC history class with Dave Chappelle, actually. He sat next to me. He was just like this little guy from Ohio who's super nice.
I'm gonna ask an annoying question, but yeah. How funny was he?
He wasn't cracking jokes, but he was really, really nice. Like very socially engaged, which is usually the sign of, you know, it's like people that are really successful like that are really good socially.
He was bright, obviously. He was very sharp, it sounds like.
Very, oh yeah. Yeah, he was. I didn't know him well, but we sat next to each other in DC history. But the high school was amazing. I just like there were musicians that would come visit and play, and we'd do master classes. Like Joe Pass, this jazz guitar player, came to play for us, and yeah, we got a master class with like Wynton Marsalis, and that was super cool. And oh, here's a cool thing. Earth, Wind, and Fire came to give us a masterclass on the music business, which was incredible. And I wish I had like videotaped it. Yes. Yeah, I wish I had videotaped that. 1987.
It was a lot harder to videotape things in 1987.
It was. Now. Yeah, I know. But that was so inspiring as a weird little depressed kid just be around this like totally different world and be so inspired by the kids that I went to school with, my teacher, like all these, you know, successful musicians were coming through the school. Like Dionne Warwick spoke at the graduation. Anyway, so that was super inspiring. And just like, I was like, oh, I don't have to be depressed. And like, you know, it just showed me that like, if I did music, that I wouldn't be depressed. So that was cool.
Yeah, it's so important to have those people, like to see somebody being successful at it, to see that somebody has been able to make a career. Obviously, like it's a very different story now, but that, you know, I hear this from a lot of people. Like, again, I interview a lot of cartoonists, and this comes up a lot with people who make comics. They're like, I didn't realize that you could do this for a living until such and such.
Yeah. Right. Like until, yes. It's wild. You know, it makes such a difference. I mean, it's such a gift to get that at that age. It really is. I mean, it's like makes, either makes you able to do it or not. So thank God when things like, you know, like when we're given those opportunities as kids.
It sounds like in a very real sense that like music itself was your way of connecting with people and the world.
As a
kid, yeah. But I mean, you know, now and person. Forever
yes,
and ever.
That is true. No, you're right. Yes, that's true. Yeah. Yes, it is true. I think that's why, you know, I got into it, which I've heard other people say too. I mean, especially with music, it's such a social art form that you kind of get drawn into it because it's thing that people usually like is that you're connecting with other musicians and you need each other to be able to make it, unless you're just a solo, you know, person. That's why that's a little bit more scary, I think, because you're not actually connecting with the band members, you're connecting with the audience, which is the whole different thing. But I think it's a nice, I found as a younger person, I think I found it was like a way I could connect with other people and not be anxious and shy. I don't know if I was aware of that, but that's what was happening.
From my perspective, you had two really important things happening at around the same time. So there's that. And then, you know, you're in a band with Alec Mackay. There's like being in DC at this moment when
that's true, right?
You know, you were getting like, you know, Maurice White and Dionne Warwick making a living, but then the other end, you were seeing like, oh, that you don't have to be a superstar. Yeah, yeah, kids,
yeah,
exactly.
That was like the main thing that I think was going to punk shows in DC. And yeah, because it was just, inspiring in many different ways, I would say. Mostly what I got from it was, A, it was fun because it was my friends that I would go see play and see it shows, but B, it was like anybody could do it, and it was kids, and it was like people my age or a little bit older. And there was also this thing about it was more like little gangs. It wasn't really art. I didn't think of it as that. People weren't trying to be good. They were just trying to be angry and trying to say what they felt. And it was also kind of like little gangs. It really was. It was like these dudes in these little gangs. That's what that scene was like, which is cool. But it was a whole thing. Also, I think another inspiring thing about it was just, it was a whole fucking like cool underground weird network of these people doing something that was not anywhere else except for here. It was so local, and no one was trying to get a big job and be successful, and no one was trying to even be successful with their music, because it wasn't about success or money or anything. It was about being in a gang and connecting with other kids, and about that's really all it was about. Yeah, it was about, yeah, just like the little network, the little universe in DC and other punk scenes, local punk scenes. And it was really sort of like a, I don't know, in some ways it was weird. It was like a bunch of humans figuring out a thing to do that wasn't related, but making it up all on their own because it wasn't supposed to be related to anything else. Like, here are some instruments. Let's figure out what to do with these. Well, you know what I mean? Like, not learn how to play them from anyone else but ourselves. So then ultimately that is sort of also frustrating to me too, because like nobody, I don't know. It's easy to just like not care about your instrument and get, cause I didn't really feel like I fit in. Cause I wanted to be a good guitar player. I did fit in with my voice cause I don't know how to sing. I'm like a punk singer. So I'm a weird combination. Anyway, so I don't know. It was very inspiring to be around. Yeah, I would say.
Obviously, you know him now. I don't know how well you knew him at the time, but I mean, is there an extent to which Ian was kind of an exception to some of those things about taking it, you know, seriously in that way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. You know, what's something kind of cool is I've known Ian and Alex since I've been a tiny kid, because we grew up on the same street actually until I was five, and then my parents kept the house as a rental, so I was always back on Beecher Street.
Ian's a bit older, but is Alec is closer to your age, right?
Alec is my brother's age, which is 3 years older, and Ian is 8 years older, I think. But so I love those guys, and it's weird. I've actually known them for ever since I've been the little child. But no, Ian has been an incredibly inspiring person to me and to many people, you know, made up his own rules and done things his own way, and along the way helped a lot of people by supporting other bands and, you know, starting this whole label. And he was one of the first people I remember who was really supportive. He was always so supportive. That the other thing about the punk scene in DC is how supportive it was. People really cared about other people's bands, and not at all. I don't remember that. Although you hear other people saying that they wanted to kick out the jams and, like, you know what I mean? Like, I've heard Ian saying that. It's like all about, you know, it's like when you do a show, it's like all about the whole thing, kick out the jams, like, where you're trying to, yes, yeah. So, but at the same time, everyone in that scene was really supportive. And Ian being the main dude in that scene, yeah, I just remember him always being very interested. He's always very interested in what people are doing, and supportive.
When did you first have the courage to get up in front of people and perform?
Honestly, yeah, it was from being around punk shows, because it was just this feeling like, your turn, you know what I mean? It was like the show was like, okay, see how my friends' bands play, and now like who's gonna be in another band and play. It was just it didn't seem as scary to play that kind of music, I think, so, as opposed to like doing a recital in my high school, which was terrifying, but I still enjoyed that. But this is different.
Your brother ended up being a musician as well. Was it a musical house?
My brother, he started playing guitar. Well, my mom was very good about making sure we were taking music lessons. So in that sense, it was. My parents were not musicians, but my mom really spearheaded that. Yep. And so, yeah, no, my brother, I learned so much from him, and he ended up like studying classical composition in college, and he was really good. But he, oh, and then another cool thing about him is he got into playing guitar. Like, have you ever seen anyone do two-handed guitar, like tapping, like Stanley Jordan? Well, it was a big thing in the 80s. Not a big thing, but there were people in the 80s, like this guy named Stanley Jordan, who played only with two hands on the guitar, on the neck. Like, he didn't strum, he just tapped with both hands, so it sounds more like a piano or a harpsichord or something. So my brother did this thing where he traveled around in Europe for like a while after college, like 5 or 6 years after college, busking on the street with tapping guitar. He's really good. He played like Bach and all this awesome stuff. So he writes really good songs that no one will ever hear because he doesn't want to put them out in the world, but he's super so talented.
You've had projects that really intersected with what was going on in the Northwest at the time, like Wild Flag again.
Uh-huh.
How aware or connected were you with that Riot Girl scene at the time?
I was playing in this band called Autoclave here in DC in the late 80s or 1990 maybe. And I didn't, I think that's right when everything started happening with Riot Girl. So then I went to Boston to go to college and I would come back here and practice. And one summer I came back and like, the whole Riot Girl thing had really taken off here. Cause Bikini Kill, I think, was living here. And so was Bratmobile. Some of the people from Bratmobile are from here, but, and they were on the scene and it was awesome. And there was like Riot Girl meetings and the whole thing was like really happening here. So that was really cool. And that's how I found out about all that stuff. Then I got to be friends with some people out in Olympia. There was like a connection between DC and Olympia. Like, people were friends and like, I guess I got to be friends a couple years later with Carrie Brownstein, and I would go out and visit her and hang out in Olympia and stuff. So I always really liked what was happening out there because it was punk, but there were way more women involved, which there were not here. And when
why I ask.
Yeah. No, when I was growing up going to these punk shows, which is only a few years earlier, but of course when you're that age it seems like a last generation ago, which is really is only like 1985, 86, 87. It was all guys and bands here. And then and this woman who Christina Blatt, who is a total genius, who I love so much, she wanted to start a band and literally hit me up because I was like one of the only girls she knew that played guitar, you know, at the time, like that would go to punk shows. So we tried to start a band and we tried for like a few years, but we could never find the right drummer. But anyway, finally I went to college and she found Melissa and Nikki and started jamming and then invited me. And
we talked a little bit about whether it was a musical house, you know, as you said, your parents weren't musicians, but something that like really resonated with me in a recent interview that you did, I think maybe last year, when you were talking about everything that was happening in your life and record and your father, who wasn't a huge music fan.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of this was the sort of the dementia, but like,
yeah,
he got really into it and you bonded over that.
Oh my God, it was so wonderful. He always liked one thing that I loved about my dad is that he loved reading and learning about stuff, and he loved poetry, but he never really liked music that much. But when he got sick, suddenly, for whatever biological reason or whatever reason, he had just not been aware of it his whole life, he just suddenly loved music. So, one day he asked me who the greatest poet of Canada was, and I was trying to figure out what he was talking about, and I was like Googling on my phone, like greatest poet of Canada, and I kept saying names, and he was like, nope, nope. So I had to, and he's like, text my friend and ask them. So I did, and his friend.
He had an answer in mind when he was asking you this?
Well, he had dementia, so not full on, though, just, you know, medium. Yes, he knew. Yeah. He just couldn't remember. So I asked his tennis buddy in Florida, and they got back to me and said, well, I'm a big fan of Leonard Cohen, so I think he's talking about Leonard Cohen. So then I said, Dad, Leonard Cohen. And he's like, yes, Leonard Cohen. So then I got him like this box set of on Amazon of like all of Leonard Cohen's CDs. And his main activity would be listening to Leonard Cohen. And he just couldn't get enough. It was over and over and over. And he got fixated on certain songs. And then he just liked singing them by himself, too. It was amazing. And also, William Butler Yeats, the Lake Isle of Innisfree poem. Every time I went over, he would get up out of his chair and start saying the poem. And then I would say it along with him. Yeah. And also, some Bob Dylan. So he really just, oh, and another cool thing they were doing is, my mom found, when she was doing, okay, she found this joke club for them to go to. So they were doing a joke club every week, which is so cute.
What is a joke club?
It was for older people, especially people with memory loss. And they just tell jokes in a room every week.
I should have guessed that.
Yeah. It was wonderful. So my mom would look up a bunch of jokes on Google, print them all out, and then they would go tell the jokes. It was awesome. Do I remember any of them? Oh, God.
We're going to end on one of your mom's jokes.
No, because I can't remember. Oh, wait. Wait, hold on. Let me look. Okay, a policeman stops a man driving down the street with two penguins who are sitting quite comfortably in the back seat of his convertible. Sir, he says, you've broken the law. You can't have penguins in your car. Take them to the zoo immediately. The next day, the policeman stops the same man who's driving down the street with the penguins, but this time the penguins are wearing hats and sunglasses. Sir, I told you to take those penguins to the zoo. Oh, but I did, replied the man. We had a great time, and today we're going to the beach.
When I met you, you were talking like a madman who just got high.